You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, it is Thursday, and joining me Thursday, as they do, in order of intellectual capability, Will Cosentini. Will, how you doing?
I defer to Jeff.
Tim Lynch joins me from McAllen, Texas. Tim, how are you?
I too defer to Jeff. That's the way we are.
And the intellectual weakling of the group, Jeff Kinney, joins me from San Clemente, California. What's going on, Jeff?
Hello, Matt. Anchorman reporting in.
There you go.
And proud of it.
Quick poll. Our relationship with China, are we adversaries, competitors, or enemies? Jeff, since you're the smartest person.
Enemies.
Tim?
Adversaries.
Will?
Adversaries, trending enemies.
Is that a category? I don't think it is. Adversary. Okay. I say we're enemies. Okay. So, Jeff, footnote. Why are we enemies?
Because I think they launched a biological attack on us late last year, which is now known as the coronavirus, and they did that in a bid to try and maintain, their path towards world domination, which we, since 2017, have been stifling them. Where before that, we were, arguably aiding them in that march.
All right. And since I'm on Jeff's side, right, I would say that, they've been conducting cyber operations and influence operations in the United States, in my opinion, that are beyond the pale, and that they are attempting to usurp the current world order and replace it with their own. We just don't want to admit it. And so I think it's our reluctance to, we're still playing to a certain extent, still playing the emperor's new clothes. Oh, we love the Chinese, blah, 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 blah. In the meantime, they're killing us. Tim, adversaries, explain that.
Well, I choose to interpret this recent infection from the COVID-19 as being an accident, no doubt a man-made accident and a sloppy one. And I feel that we can get much more out of China by continuing to be as engaged as a country who's withdrawing all their factory output out of that country, remain as engaged as we could be. Because let me posit something to you. It's easier for us to maintain access or gain access and maintain surveillance and stuff on their stuff when we've got Americans coming in and out of there, particularly scientists and whatnot, because all of them think that they're secret agents. But more importantly, there's been a huge disparity in capability, because after the sex tent virus thing was revealed in Iran and they started tracing back to see where the weakness was, what they found was the CIA had a temporary platform for their agents to check in, thrown up after 9/11, that was never really gone. They didn't go back and harden it. It was child's play. So the Iranians and Chinese broke in and eliminated every asset the CIA had in both those countries. Right. Plus, you had Dianne Feinstein, who headed the Judiciary Intelligence Committee, her driver for 20 years. It was a paid spy from China. Let us assume now that these hemorrhages are over, that we are reestablishing some type of a capability. And I think as long as we maintain those guys as adversaries and not enemies, we at least have an opportunity to get in and start getting information that we need that would be denied us if we were in a state of hostilities.
Got it. All right. Will, adversaries trending towards enemies. Explain.
when did Japan become our enemy? Was it, at 8 o'clock Pacific time on December 7th, before that, were they our enemy or our adversary? So maybe I'm just splitting hairs on this, but that's what I mean when I say adversary trending enemy. It was obvious to a lot of people, in the late 30s, 1940, early 41, that Japan was likely to be an enemy soon. but I don't think they count him as an enemy yet.
Do you – well, let's talk about that. So do you think that that was the reason that we got hammered, at Pearl Harbor, our failure to admit the obvious and then take – you know, those precautions, the appropriate precautions, because, you know, at dawn we slept. Are we committing the same mistake again by not realizing somebody who speaks nicely to us and yet is below the waterline and just barely below the waterline, doing everything that, you know, looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, but it's not a duck. Are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that at that time there were plenty of people that saw Japan as a potential belligerent, and you know, there's a lot of micro tactical reasons that we were sleeping at dawn. But at a strategic level, the analogy may be apt.
I think that might be the first word the first time anybody used the word apt.
Yeah, I've been searching my dictionary because Jeff's been kicking our ass.
I know. I mean, Jeff went literary on everybody. What did you say last week that was like literary? Like you were writing instead of speaking.
Might as well be last century, man. My memory doesn't go that far.
It does too. It does. You're like,
I got no discipline on it. It just pops in there like herpes, you know? I can't
All right. Are we whistling? To me, I mean, you say arbitrary. Are we whistling past the graveyard relative to China as they continue to pick our back pocket? Because oddly enough, like all their technology looks really a lot like ours. Is there a cost to that?
Yeah, of course there's a cost to it in lost dollars but then again the country that's mimicking and reverse engineering stuff, they've got a lot of things they have to get right that I don't think they have the capabilities of doing on their own. Quite frankly, if I understand the aero technology business these days, but yeah, it's certainly frustrating. But again, right now they're kind of integral to our economy and everybody else's economy. As we disengage from that, which I sincerely hope we do, it's best to have as much access as we can to that country, because there's no doubt that in their mind they're in war. If you believe what they wrote in the 1990s about a war being economic and the war transcending just military conflict, there's no question they're trying to get out and push their influence, as you know, and get their way as fast as they can. And they're running into friction, and so which is good. They're going to run into to friction, but it's no reason, I think, to look at them and right now start treating them as if they were a potential hostile armed belligerent. Because I don't see what's gained that way.
So, okay. Right. Jeff, your thoughts? So, you say enemy. Yeah. So how should we treat him?
Well, here's just a couple things. The comparison to Japan in 1941 is, wait for it, an apt one. Because our trade policy with Japan then was booming, with the exception of the one thing they needed most. We put an embargo on, or Roosevelt did, an embargo on them in August of 1941 that shut off their oil and rubber and other, you know, things you need to prosecute modern war in 1941. So there's that. And then I agree 100% with Will about the reason we got surprised in Pearl Harbor has a lot to do also with not so much surprised in a strategic or, you know, national sense as it is those tactical things that they were doing pretty or they had SOPs to do and they just weren't well executed. It could have been worse for us. So we could have lost the carriers also, you know, at Pearl Harbor. But then to go to the Japanese, you know, I agree with Tim too that it might not have been premeditated for them to launch this biological thing that hit us. But they're the ones who, one of the Chinese philosophers, I don't know, it was Sun Tzu or one of those other guys, oft times quoted by General Krulak, that, you know, that when crisis, the Chinese sign for crisis and opportunity is the same one. So when they did have this horrid accident, you know, based out of that lab in Wuhan that came out, they immediately said, how can we make, how can we make an omelet out of these broken eggs? And so they shut down the travel from Wuhan to other parts of China, but opened up travel from Wuhan to everywhere else, particularly, you know, places in Europe and the United States. So that's what I mean when I say, you know, I kind of agree that they really probably thought, okay, now it's time to launch biological warfare. But since there had been a biological accident there, they're like, well, we're not going to just suffer this thing. I mean, a responsible nation would have closed down all travel in and out of Wuhan to anywhere, you know, out of just humanity. But they didn't. They cynically and basically, I mean, it's almost like these sickos you got now who know they have HIV or are going out there having sex with people without telling them. You know, it's kind of it's like the same thing on a national level. So that's my attitude towards that. You know?
Well,
and then the other thing, one more thing, if you don't mind.
Sure.
There's the willful looking the other way, because is something I think is personified in the faces of Christopher Wray and Gina Haspel. Because if they look at what's going on and report it for what it is, that presupposes then an obligation to do something about it. And that is something which takes which will take a lot of courage on a national level. And so they don't want to present the National Command Authority with this is what happened and this is why. And now, you know, it's a direct provocation. They don't want to do that. They'd rather look at something that's, a rabid dog and say, no, that's a harmless puppy.
Well, let me say this and reveal you rubes for the fools that you are. I know people, right? Everybody knows. You three know how well connected I am, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I say that kind of tongue in cheek, but kind of not. Anyway, I know some people, and I know somebody who does work like relative to China. And here's what they told me. Do you think that this is an accident? If I told you that this is a dress rehearsal for a subsequent event, would you believe me?
Yes.
And I started shaking. I said, yes.
I'm shaking now.
I said, yes. And and this person said this to me. If you believe this is an accident, you're a fool. And I was like, whoa. And again, I go back to my first experiences in Iraq, where I was challenged to believe that things I saw repeatedly were coincidences. And then I deduced that it's not a coincidence. I'm seeing that because they want me to see that. And it's colored my view of what a coincidence is ever since. And so, let your rubes be forewarned. That only a fool believes in coincidences. And there was some kind of unexplained, to this date, unexplained accident. Right?
Ooh.
Unexplained accident. Right. So,
Can Nostradamus get in here?
Sure.
Okay. In January, we were talking on, and you mentioned something like, what do you got your eyes on, or something like that. And I said, this lockdown in China, they've got 600 or 300 million or some ungodly number equal to our entire country locked down because of this virus escape. I said, that's fascinating. At that time, it never occurred to me that as part of that lockdown wasn't air traffic leaving out of there. It never occurred to me that you could not fly out of Wuhan to Peking, but you could fly out of Wuhan to New York City. That never even occurred to me. So that kind of argues towards what Jeff and you were saying. That's one of those things that can't be explained. And also, I said from the Nostradamus side, the way I knew that this thing wasn't what they said it was is the lack of bodies, because we can't be ahead of a virus. It's impossible. So had it been as deadly, if it had the morbidity and mortality as first advertised, there would have been bodies all over the place in March. We would have noticed it. It would have been so obvious as to everybody that it would have been, but it was very scary. So now when you start talking about a dress rehearsal, that, my friend, is concerning, because everybody thinks walking around with a mask is going to protect them and not against a bad bug at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We talked about, in fact, I think Will gave us a little bit of an education about strategic ambiguity in Taiwan, I believe. Is that true, William?
I talked about it a little bit, yes.
Okay. I like calling you William, and I like calling Jeff Jeffrey. Jeffrey, it immediately puts Jeffrey on the defensive because he knows normally that word is associated with him getting into trouble. Paul Wolfowitz wrote a piece, and I hate to even say that shithead's name, but he wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal that I saw that I thought was interesting, and it's entitled "The Korean War's Lesson for Taiwan." Stalin nixed Kim Il-sung's plan to invade the South until he was convinced. What? Right, until he was convinced that the United States would not strike back. And so, Wolfowitz, I'll just read you a couple sentences. Deterrence rests on a paradox. The best way to prevent a war is to threaten a war. The history of the 20th century illustrates that successful deterrence can accomplish that. Deterrence enabled West Berlin to survive as a free city despite a political status even more ambiguous than Taiwan's and a truly indefensible military position. Cold War history also illustrates a corollary. A failure of resolve can invite catastrophe. I can read. The Korean War was preventable if the U.S. had made clear beforehand they would forcefully oppose North Korean aggression.
Right.
And so,
World War One, that doesn't stand because World War One, everybody was ready for war and threatening each other, and then they actually called each other's bluff, and that's what happened.
World War Two, though, had we enforced the Versailles Treaty early on in the mid to late 30s, maybe you wouldn't have had 70 million people die in World War Two.
Maybe, but I think Hitler was bound and determined to cause a.
Yeah, but have that war in 1936 when he doesn't have a shit.
Yeah, you're right about that. We didn't really have shit either then, but you're right.
We had more shit. We, the Brits and the French, had more shit, except we didn't really want to go to war. So does that change the way you feel, William, about your strategic ambiguity doctrine? I mean, I know you just explained it to us, but I think that you should put not only the United States, but, ASEAN, the United Nations, say, hey, look, this shit needs to dial down. Taiwan is a sovereign and free nation. I thought that was a purpose of the UN to do shit like that.
Well, Michael. my point of being overly explicit is that you can back yourself into a corner. If we say China is not going to take Taiwan by force. Seems simple, right?
Right.
Well, what happens if they just cruise up to the beach? What happens if they put a flag on an unoccupied little rock off the coast? When you are overly explicit, you invite tests to that to see where your line is going to be, and then you can be misinterpreted as backing off from one of those tests, therefore inviting it. We have with Taiwan, I believe we have communicated, you're not going to take Taiwan by force. I thought your discussion on China a few minutes ago was good, but your comment about isn't the UN supposed to do that? Give me a freaking break.
That was a bit of humor. Have you lost all sense, William?
I'm not sure that I've ever been known as the humor man.
You know what? That my friend, there have been no truer words ever spoken on this program than that.
I caught 3 minutes of the show before you came on.
Yes.
Stavridis.
Yeah,
he was the guy that put out the Fighting Admirals,
which is another piece of humor. Timothy Jeffrey, any comment about ambiguity in Taiwan? Do you think the United States should say, "Yeah, that isn't going to happen"? See, I think the United States should do it with ASEAN And I don't know. I mean, the UN, you know, the only thing that was missing was the rim shot relative to that. Any thoughts on how we should go about this?
I think making it explicit, especially with our new Quad partners, Australia, India, Japan, if issuing it under that that organization, I think would be a powerful statement. And look, we've already slipped our secret cultural weapon into that country. We've just got to give it 60 years to go. It's 60 years from now. You wait and see. Inner China, there'll be McDonald's and KFCs, and they'll be on insulin and needing diabetes care, just like the Arabs. You wait and see. You wait and see. So it's just a matter of time. We just got to hold the edge until the McDonald's and the donuts take over, because that stuff is like crack cocaine overseas, as you well know.
Oh, that is true. That is true.
Yeah, all those people go crazy over that. That's all they'll eat. They'll eat that crap all day long.
It tastes good.
Yeah. Bats and lizards, man.
Okay. They do it in the tallow over there, like in Dubai. That stuff. They just got like laws against cold fries, for crying out loud. That's the best food you've ever eaten over there. And they eat a lot of it.
Jeffrey, any thoughts on Taiwan?
Well, there's about the fried chicken and McDonald's. They made jujitsu us, and before you know it, we're eating butter fried bats over here and the lizards and stuff.
But I will tell you that.
Instead of chicken nuggets, you get bat chicken or something like that. Mm. But to say about that, I think that I agree with the ambiguity thing is good. But I think when it comes to ASEAN, we should make strong statements as a alliance with us with them, but not be explicit about who's going to do what.
Okay, so general statement saying we as ASEAN stand with Taiwan, and right. You know, no, again, I see, to me, this whole thing is, if we don't go there with our allies, and again, to and really what I believe we're preserving is the economic order of the world, right? And that, right. You know, and putting China on notice, you will join us, we will not join you. So I think that's interesting. I want to talk about race in the Marine Corps. Okay. Now, I wanted to talk about this. I would throw this out, and I want to get your reaction to it. In talking to people yesterday, and I talked to maybe four or five people, the Marine Corps would be overrepresented by minorities on the enlisted side. All right. On the officer side, we would be underrepresented. And as you go higher, what you find, right, according to a number of people I spoke to, is the institution promoting minorities ahead of peers, looking to promote them, right, to greater and greater rank, right? And so the problem when you talk to people that have served on the recruiting side is for the high-end minority candidate for the military is a very, very small group. They have the world at their feet. And so 90 plus percent of them will not entertain such an idea. And so then what you do is you fight for a small portion of those who would make the military a career. And then, you know, you hopefully, you know, you get those that could get to high rank. That is my experience is that you see people advance very quickly. You know, you see women. I want to say the selection rate from lieutenant colonel to colonel for women is extremely high. And so that is my experience. Yet the narrative is that there's some bias in the Marine Corps. The narrative isn't. It is extremely competitive, right, for that slice of the minority population. But the institution itself does everything it can to promote them. Okay, so that's reality as I know it. That's not the popular narrative that somehow or other Marine Corps is biased against minorities. Jeff, you go first this time. Your experience relative to minorities, is it that the institution is biased against it? Is it the institution looks for them and actively tries to promote? What have you to say about that, which I just threw out?
Well, I generally go along with what you were saying. I mean, both in regards to my service as an enlisted guy and then as an officer. Although my first 4 years in the Marine Corps, actually first 5 or 6 years, we had issues with race. We had issues with drugs. We had issues with the standards of our recruit. But that really was related to we had standards we were trying to raise for our for the actual enlisted Marine. So, you know, that got better as we raised standards, as we held the line on things like drug abuse and, you know, and other stuff. So there just wasn't an issue, you know, from the 80s on. You had people calling each other names, but they, you know, it was just a, it wasn't really, it wasn't a showstopper like it had been in like 1977 or something.
Well, but, and again, to me, just one thing. To me, there's this. I think a huge line between what we all know is, look, there's bigots everywhere. Okay, yeah. There just are. Whether anybody cares to admit it, there's bigots everywhere, and so racism. But there's a huge difference between systemic racism and anecdotal racism, right? Yeah. Or racism that's tolerated. And I could tell you from, well, at least just my personal experience, I don't know anywhere where when somebody played the race card or did that, that they didn't get their asses crushed.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, back to you. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, and then when I got into the recruiting business, both as an enlisted guy and as an officer, there's absolutely no difference in what I experienced and what you said. When I was an enlisted guy, they were starting to really raise the standards on high school grads and police involvement and just zero tolerance for drug use. And I put in mostly personally when I was out beating the bushes myself personally, most of the people I put in were Hispanic Americans, specifically Mexican Americans. And I would have dreamed about having a platoon of those guys. They're all pretty good. I mean, I had a couple. I had one non-grad who was a white kid who went UA from Edson Range in boot camp. And, you know, so I thought, man, the system's right. You know, non-grads are more of a fucking problem. And then when I became the CEO of Pittsburgh as an officer, I really got exposed to the challenges of the officer selection officers and trying to find the people you're talking about, the minorities and women who you know, for officer sessions. And that was hard for them because of exactly what you said. These people had a lot of choices, and it was a hot competition to try and get them to join. And different parts of the country have different propensities. Everybody knows that, you know.
Right.
It's almost like math, that where there's a high propensity, you got challenges with the ASVAB. I mean, I think I hate to say that, but, you know, like down south, the 6th Marine Corps District, they could fill the Marine Corps with people, but a lot of their schools suck, and so you end up with a bunch of low ASVAB sessions, you know. But when it came to officers, you know, it was very difficult for those guys. Lucky for me, the Marine Corps never had a problem getting officers, and even minority officers. We get a fair representation, you know, on the national level, but it never satisfied the questioning angels of the media, you know, and they come looking for that. And it was usually handled with clay feet by a spokesman like General Mundy and so forth. They weren't very good at explaining, you know, the facts of it. If they had you explain it like you did in the beginning of this thing, we wouldn't have had a lot of trouble we had, like with, you know, in the early 90s.
And I didn't know that stuff until, you know, I began asking the questions, and you talk to recruiters and they'll tell you, look, don't just talk to us, talk to corporate recruiters too. If you're talented minority, right? And again, one of them, I can't remember who it was, but somebody said to me, look, the determiner of rank, the one thing that you can correlate between rank and achievement is GCT, your intelligence,
right,
and they said that correlates to everybody, and so, and then he said the competition for that guy, for that girl, is off the hook, and so you know, you do your best to get them, you know, but you live with what you live with, and so it wasn't I had never really thought about that. I'd never been a recruiter. So I just found that I'd never really thought about how keen the competition is for that slice, how small the slice is that would consider the military, and then you've got to attempt to lure them into the Marine Corps. Timmy, your thoughts?
Well, as you recall, I had to put a white kid in as an African American because he had been fortunately born in South America, and I had personally called, I think, every African-American kid in high school in Montana and friggin' Idaho and Utah who was having good grades and whose information we could pull. And they not a one of them were interested in going into the service. They all had much, much better offers. And one of them was the son of the Bozeman High School principal who I was good friends with. And he said, yeah, you'll never get my kid. Shut up. So that was been my experience. Like Jeff, when I was enlisted in 79, 80, 81, there was definitely racist problems in the military. I recall that being sorted out about 83 when they started the Operation Piss Test and throwing people out at the cyclic rate. All that seemed to have suddenly disappeared. But my experience in the Marine Corps is that we do everything we can to attract and maintain qualified minority applicants, minus lowering our standards to the point where you've got to start helping them get through OCS. We don't do that. And the only criticism I'm seeing about our process that might be something worthy of consideration is, you know, when you get into TBS, you've got to compete. And in order to compete, there's a few things you've got to be able to do well: shoot, swim, and land navigate. Perhaps having some kind of a course to get those of all races, because it's not like all the white kids can land navigate and African Americans can't. That's not the case. It's that the guys who end up in a lower third, there seems to be a higher proportion of African Americans as they're represented in the thing. You know, we've all got plenty of friends that are top third guys that are outstanding officers, right? But you could do that with minority to try to give them a leg up. It would help the Naval Academy guys too, for crying out loud, because they're half sloppy when they show up. They haven't been through OCS, but I think outside of that, there's nothing that you could point to within our service where you could say, oh, look, there it is. Because I called up Will a couple of weeks ago and I asked him during his time on the second deck, I said, have you ever heard, did you ever receive a complaint or hear of white supremacy or Confederate flags or any of that kind of stuff? He goes, I never heard a word. So I wonder, when you hear the commandant mention these things, I wonder what the hell he's talking about. Because it's not self-evident to me that we don't bend over backwards to do everything we can to sustain and promote folks that are underrepresented in our general officer structure.
And I will say this. I mean, you used to see, you know, Confederate flags, right, decals and what, but they tended to be, and this is just me, kids from the South. It was their Southern pride, blah, 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 blah. And it wasn't a statement about white supremacy. It was they're from rural Georgia or whatever. And there was never any question about that being some symbol of racism. Right. And now that has been amplified, and it is now, but it was a symbol of this Southern pride thing. And so that has changed. And anyway, let me get Will in here. Will?
Yeah, I think the problem that we have is we don't know what the problem is.
There it is.
We think that we have a problem, but is the Marine Corps supposed to be the preeminent force and readiness warfighting organization? Then if it is, we actually shouldn't care. We should set standard, recruit people to the standard, bring them into the family. And if the family is 100% black, 100% purple, 100% lesbian, we actually don't care. But the problem is, we bow to people who tell us we're supposed to care, and that somehow by having an exact representation that's in the population, we're going to be better. But there is no positive way to prove that. So it's a feel good exercise. And once you get into that, there ain't nothing you can do. You tried to make someone happy. That was your first mistake. You just got to get over trying to make people happy and build the organization based on very transparent standards, methodologies, et cetera, that everyone can look to and say, you know what? That group is exactly what they say they are, and they're going to defend us, and we can depend on them. You know, and just to go after a little bit, and I don't know, I think we've been through this before, but when you go to a promotion board, a statutory requirement of the promotion board is to have a minority and I think a female member. I'm not sure if the female can count as a minority. So that means that every promotion board has got minority representation. And when I first learned that, I asked the question, well, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to be advocating for minorities on that board? If they are, that seems wacko to me. Or are they just sort of a little bit of cover that the Congress wrote a law and the president signed it, and now it's a law, so that we can say, hey, we had a minority representation on there. Our promotion boards can't be racist. And so what you have is this ridiculous thing that requires a minority or a female to be on our promotion boards. And if it's one thing that says, well, look, these are the people that are keeping an eye on us, I would say if you need to keep an eye on us, then all those people you think are racist that need to be have an eye kept on, fire them. Or we should be trumpeting the fact that our promotion system is not racist. Look, we've had minority or female representation on every single promotion board since I don't know when, I think at least the 80s. So all you people that say we promote and we hold people back based on race, look, we did exactly what everyone said we should do, and none of these people ever complained. And they were inside the fence watching it. So once you go down this path that you're trying to make people happy without a logical connection to what the organization is about, and people say, oh, you know, you've got to have a representation of America so that Americans keep faith.
Yes.
Oh, stop it. Americans lose faith in the Marine Corps the day that we can't take the beach. That's when they lose faith. And until then, they have no idea what we look like. The people that are throwing rocks at us hate us. They have no idea who we are. They would never be part of us. They never call the commandant up and say, hey, Dave, how can I help you? What problems do you have that I can help you with? They never do that. They hate us, they throw rocks at us, and they don't care. So we should just ignore them.
William, obviously not considering a run for public office anytime soon. The commandant doesn't share your opinion, certainly. You know, every time he speaks in public, you know, his first comments are about diversity.
Yeah, and again, you know where was really diverse? The Balkans. We saw how that worked out.
Wait.
This idea that diversity makes us stronger is insanity.
Yeah.
Whoa.
A melting pot makes us stronger. A single unifying thought and ethos makes us stronger. But how are we stronger as a nation by having white supremacists, black nationalists, Antifas? How does that make – that's all diversity. And the other part of diversity, when the commandant talks about diversity and says we need to be representative, so does that mean that all black people think alike? That actually sounds very racist to me.
Yeah.
It's absolute insanity if you ask the second or third question.
Well, thank God nobody does. Because
no.
Then we would be, look, because I don't think our civilian population doesn't look at, you know, I don't think there's any doubt in their mind like that we could actually go get our ass kicked and that our existence as a nation, that's not an American experience. So it's not a thought. So the question of making the American military more reflective of the culture, I mean, well, of course we would do that because, I mean, there is no question about, you know, the survival of the nation. That's not a question. And so to me, when that's not a question, then it does become a tool for social experiments and whatever else, because you're not at risk. And if you're not at risk, then the true function, for instance, the Israelis, these discussions don't last very long in Israel. Okay? Because they know we got very precious land. We cannot lose. We have to defend, you know, blah, 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 blah. And any nation that looks down the barrel of somebody else's weapon doesn't have these existential, you know, they have existential conversations, not these, not diversity conversations. So, but again, look at the Commandant, look at the CNO. I mean, everything that comes out of their mouth, right? The first thing better be about diversity and inclusion, or else you're not long for the job. So I don't want to say you're out of touch, William, but right, you might want to read a paper every once in a while.
Yeah, I've been out of touch on this since I first heard about it. I've never fundamentally understood it. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I would say
anybody ever ask about the makeup of the guys that raise a flag on Iwo Jima?
I've never seen that.
No.
I've never seen that.
No one cared what the 1st Marine Division looked like at Chosin Reservoir.
How about did anybody care what the 2nd Marine Division looked like floating in the lagoon at Tarawa?
No. Not a bit.
I've never seen
that. Not a bit. And I heard throughout my entire career, this is the best Marine Corps has ever been. And I got to tell you something. In 2004, I thought that for sure. I said that organization I was with in 2004 was better than any other parts of the Marine Corps I'd been in up to that time. So if we're better than we've ever been, how come we're so fucked up?
Yeah.
Because we're not diverse enough.
Because it's not 2004 anymore.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I know. But
you know, the whole diversity thing is predicated on exactly the same thing as Black Lives Matter. It's quicksand. And we've taken an organization that was diverse but all met the same standard for the same goal, and now we've absolutely reversed that. Now we've got to, in order to be diverse, we can't have the same standards and the same goal, which means that you're basically destroying the institution from the inside out. And you have these senior officers mimicking this word stuff that we hope they're not taking seriously, but who the hell knows.
Well, let me just
tell you.
Yeah,
you'd like to hear about like a chowder club of people from all 4 of the services, you know, who are wearing stars. You get together and say, this, us acquiescing constantly to these lies and pretending that things that aren't true are true and telling our people on one hand we have uncompromising standards for behavior and performance. And then on the other hand, we don't act that way. And we're talking about choosing leadership, you know, at the small unit and then at the bigger unit levels. So and that weakens the whole officer corps at its base, because if you had to train everybody, what would a guy need to do to lead his men through Iwo Jima or the Chosin Reservoir? What would he need to do that? And so that's where you come up with those leadership traits and principles. You need all of them. And being a hypocrite isn't in there. And that's what you are when you say on one hand, we're going to have uncompromising performance standards, and then you immediately compromise them. You have to have the ability to lie to people who you're leading. And I remember General Krulak lying right in people's faces. He said there is no quota for women or for black officers in the Marine. He said that in like 98, right to a captain who said, "Sir, I have a quota." No, you don't.
That was a goal.
You know, and I don't know what happened to that guy. You know that. I mean, I remember this guy lying to us at the basic school. Same guy, determined to get as high as he could. The Marine Corps wasn't the end for General, for General Krulak. He wanted to go further, and he told us, "Why are you guys so up on this peer, you know, the peer eval thing for the lieutenants, you know, who are going through training in the basic school, where they basically rate each other? Because it's the only truth teller there is about somebody's character." Looking at it from everybody puts on a facade of to be the best they can be when the supervisor's looking at them. But when they're alone with their peers, what are they like then? Well, all the women were getting ranked the lowest because TBS is an infantry training school, and they're not able to keep up, and it was pissing these other guys off. And the only guy who stood up there and did like that captain did with General Krulak was Captain Furness, and he went back and forth with Krulak. I'm shocked that Dave ever got promoted major after that.
Major.
Remember what he did with God damn it, Drew Watson, training his company was on the last all male companies to go through after we had started that integration squad level thing. And his guys, he trained them back the old way, 20 mile hump, all that shit, And Krulak's showing up in the mornings in the chow hall questioning lieutenants. And some of them, of course, they're basically not even like PFCs in experience. And they're like, well, these other companies don't have to do what we're doing, sir. We don't see why, And then he's trying to fuck with Watson's career because of that. So
no,
it's the cowardice at the higher levels. I have to tell you, that's manifested itself in this war, the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. We started out pretty good. We had a good product going in 2003, but because of the hypocrisy of the thing, having a swallow when you know what they're some guy who's not even there is telling you isn't true. You don't need more men. We have technology now. We don't need that. And then you get at some level. I guess it's the brigadier general or major general level. No one says shit about the fact that that's what we need. And it's not until in 2006, the Republicans lose the midterm elections. They finally get rid of Donald Rumsfeld, who should get the Navy, the Moog version of the Navy Cross for all the dead Marines he had killed, and soldiers. So that's the thing. That's the problem we got where climbing the ladder, the career ladder, for general officers means more to them than having guys who tell the truth. The last guy who told the truth, which is General Barrows, sitting there in front of Congress. And I think every senator and every senator's aide and every fucking lawyer, they looked at General Barrows and said, we got to make sure we never get guys like this again. And that's what happened. Instead of General Barrows, we got General Neller, who says, even when he doesn't have to, I'm going to still continue with this transgender and female thing because it's the right thing to do. The Marine Corps should look like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise on Star Trek. Give me a break, man. Give me a break. If we were good before, we ain't that good now.
Let me just interject something. So, to me, we've talked about the Navy and operational excellence and that we don't hear that spoken of, right? And so, when the first iterations of women in combat were discussed, the one thing that everybody was assured, the standard will not be compromised, right? That's what we all got told that the standard's not going to be. And then it was, well, we don't really have standards. So now we have to validate the standards. And that's, the one I remember is General Boehm, who I put through IOC, Jason Boehm, saying, well, only 3 of the 9 hikes at IOC will be evaluated. Like, what the fuck? I thought, what happened to everything you do here is evaluated? So what you're telling me is that you can fail 6 and pass 3 and you can go out and lead Marines? And the answer to that was yes. Yes, they all don't need to be evaluated. So it's guys like Jason Boehm, in my opinion. And Jason's a really nice guy. High functioning conformists that don't push back and say, I'm not doing that. Okay.
That's a good word. Matt. High functioning conformists. I'm going to write that down, man, because that's a perfect description. It's not bad. It's not good. It's just fact.
Right. And then one more thing about what Jeff said, that nobody says we don't have enough guys over here, but then have the balls to fucking lecture you about your moral courage and things you're doing and shit like that. Give me a fucking break on that shit. Hey, General, how about this? Why don't you lip off with the truth every 3 or 4 years? It doesn't have to be all the time, but why doesn't one of you tell the fucking truth to somebody above you? Oh, because it might compromise the franchise? Oh, I got it. Anyway, Tim?
You know, that incident that Jeff was talking about was the very first rollback of standards. It was Kulak saying we didn't need to do the McCress hike at TBS any longer because they did not have enough time to properly prepare for it. And what Watson did with his company was arrange his company commander's time. So he did a sequential number of hikes and then busted out a full McCress hike. And I don't think he was – I think that ended his career. That's how pissed off Kulak was. He said, no, you're absolutely wrong. We can definitely do this because we need to, because the McCress standard is a standard for a reason. And ever since that class, I don't believe they do the McCress hike anymore. And that just – it's one of those things that's infuriating because it's right there in front of your face. Oh, we're not going to decrease the standards, but we don't really do McCress hikes anymore. I mean, not really. No. That's the bullshit that they pull.
And the reason they don't do them is
because you can't do it with a mixed gender force. The women they're built differently. They can't walk 26 miles under a combat load. If you bring them, they're just going to shuck all their ammo. You're going to have to carry all their stuff for them.
Period. That's it. And it's not only the women; it's the weaker men too. They can't do it, and so
yeah. But weaker men don't go on deployments. That's right. The thing. You get the shit kicked in them.
Right. I know. But again, so you hear this diversity. We're not going to change the standards, and then the standard gets changed, and then you're asked to stand there and nod your head, and so to me, you know, that's the great lie. What the fifth great lie, right? The standard won't change. We're supposed to talk about stoicism and Admiral Stockdale. So let's take about, 10-15 minutes and talk about that. I have a question for you. Were you exposed to these writings of Admiral Stockdale's? The second one, I believe, was a speech he gave at Amphibious Warfare when it was in existence in the mid-90s. But were you exposed to Stockdale's writing about the Stoics when you went through the academy?
No, I got there in the summer of 81. We knew who Stockdale was because there was a lot of POW experience on the staff at that time. And that was – when you talked about the heroic Navy coming out of Vietnam, that's what they talked about was the POWs. So you knew who Stockdale was and you knew some of the things that he did. But this idea of this, Greek philosopher being the basis of that, I actually don't think that came out until later because figure he was on active duty until I want to say into the 80s. I think he was.
He didn't get the Medal of Honor until 81, right?
Yeah, so I don't think that, he hadn't written any of his books or anything like that. So I don't think that was known at the time. But you did know, and interestingly, so when you go there at the Naval Academy, you get assigned a sponsor, typically someone out in the civilian world who is like a surrogate mom or dad for you. So my sponsor was arranged for me. Was a class of 1947 from the academy. He had gotten out of the Navy and went to work for NASA. My grandfather worked for NASA. So class of 47 was Jimmy Carter, Stansfield Turner, Stockdale, Admiral Crow.
Wow.
So I knew some of those names before that because my sponsor, a guy named Chet Chidot, who's an absolutely phenomenal American, those classes were really, really tight. They graduated in 3 years instead of four, and Chet told me the only thing they missed was leave. So they knew everyone in their class and knew them well. And he knew those guys, and it was, as things would come up now and then, we'd talk about it. So I knew those names, and I knew a little bit about Stockdale, but I didn't know the Stoic and the Stoicism story until later. And I don't know when I became aware of it, but it was probably about the time in the 90s. He wrote a book, him and his wife wrote a book, and then he went, right. Did a little more speaking engagement. And then when he was Perot's running mate.
Got it. All right, Jeff, since you're the smartest guy here, let's your thoughts on.
Hey, just a second. I thought Jeffrey was the smartest guy here.
Jeffrey is the criminal element of the Kenny family.
That's Jeff.
Jeffrey, your thoughts on the Stoic philosophers and the impact on Stockdale. I found it very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because this guy Epictetus, I hope I pronounced his name right. He was actually in Rome as a slave during the time when he came up during the Claudian Emperor. He was born during the Claudian Emperor Claudius, I think. And then he came of age when those guys were – the last one was Nero, and he was killed and committed suicide at the same time. And pretty convenient. And then this guy came up. So he went from being a slave to being – semi-free, and I think that kind of turned his version of the Stoicism from the Greeks, who weren't slaves, who came up with it. You know, he actually had hard practical experience what it was like to be a slave, and when he moved and started his own school, I think in what's now Turkey, I could be wrong about that, but because the emperor of Rome at the time said, "I'm sick of these goddamn philosophers." His name is Domitian. He banned them all from Rome. So this guy went out there. But later, there was a time after that, the Roman emperors actually sought out Epictetus because, you know, his philosophy is attractive to people who perceive themselves going through suffering and are wondering why is this happening to me? And everybody, I think in their own life, it feels a little bit that way one time or another. But the Emperor Hadrian, who was one of the five good emperors, actually met him personally and corresponded with him on a regular basis because he was impressed with that type of thing. So I mean, when the head of the known world, is encouraged by your philosophy as well as people who are slaves, I mean labor slaves who have very short life expectancy, who are rowing ships or digging in mines and stuff, you know, all of them, you know, he talked to that, you know.
Timmy, your thoughts about not only just the Stoics but also the impact it had on Admiral Stockdale?
Well, it's certainly easy to see how attractive it would be to somebody in a situation as a POW. Because the one thing that the Stoics believed in fundamentally was the only thing that you own fully in your life is your will or your purpose. And that's it. Everything else, not really yours. So you're trying to develop within yourself a life that's free of passion, unmoved by joy or grief, and submissive to natural law, which in the case of POW is submissive to their circumstances. So it's easy to see why that is such a compelling a philosophy, but it's also the foundations of the Judeo-Christian Christian ethic, really. And I tell you this, I think it's something that they shouldn't be teaching at War College. I think it's something they should be teaching at TBS, because it's Stoic, using a Stoic philosophy to organize yourself as a mode of living, you could do a hell of a lot worse. And I think that it's so easy now at our to read this stuff and say, oh, I can see why that works. Because I think that guys that have led a very Stoic type lifestyle, I think they grant themselves an immunity from trauma and some of the other evils that befall men, because they have insulated themselves from the bad effect by following, basically listening to their mind. Being a man of their convictions, not going back on their word, et cetera, that armors them for the vicissitudes of life. You know, it's a big difference between Admiral Stockdale contemplating his wife back home, then contemplating his wife back home and this mistress he has in Hong Kong and that really hot one in Australia that he likes to visit when he deploys down there. Those are two different kinds of Admiral Stockdales, right? Stockdale was one of these guys, a Stoic, who didn't have confusion in his life because he was a Stoic, who had crystal clear intentions because he was a Stoic. And I think that enabled him to not only survive, but to thrive enough to provide that leadership presence to the prisoners that were there. And I don't see how else you do it other than a stripped down Stoicism that you've enabled yourself to take because you haven't screwed up so often in your past life that you can't take Stoicism seriously. You see, you understand the difference? That's why I think it's something that should be introduced to lieutenants, quite frankly, just as for no other reason. And it's a foundation of our Judeo-Christian thought of what's a responsible man and what's not. I'm just, it's one of those things I wish I had studied a hell of a lot more when I was 18 rather than when I was 58.
No, you know what? I had, as I was reading, I mean, I had the same thought. I thought, man, yeah. And you could introduce it under the guise of studying Stockdale, right? Mm-hmm. You could introduce, you know, the Stoic philosophy to people, and then some would certainly seize on it, others would not. I mean, to me, I see so many parallels with that and the concepts in post-traumatic winning, right? That you don't, you know, it's, I don't want to say it's a fatalist philosophy, but you don't, I mean, he was a slave. You don't have control over everything in life. So you can only control how you react to those things. And it's almost like, I mean, Stockdale, when he tells a story, you know, he gets sent to Stanford to study strategy so he can go be a planner, blah, blah, blah. Well, what he ultimately becomes is a philosopher at Stanford, which is an interesting kind of discussion. But he is quintessentially the perfect guy to be the senior guy at the Hanover Hilton. Through all that, I mean, it's just an amazing series of coincidences that puts him at this place to be a leader of this organization at that time. And the Stoic philosophy and everything that it embodies is really interested in how it manifests itself, and really, in my opinion, how it armors you for life. Will, your thoughts on the philosophy itself? You talked about how you were exposed to it, but your thoughts on maybe how it related to Stockdale or the philosophy itself and its applicability to military people or to life?
I would say I knew a little bit about it, but, you know, I'm a product of, you know, the education system as it is, and we never really got into ancient things. And so I read those two Stockdale papers, and I immediately said, this rhymes with post-traumatic winning. And it rhymes with other bits and pieces as you're trying to grow up in the Marine Corps and become a leader. And, you know, I wrote a couple of the bumper stickers down. It's, you know, you got to live in the moment. This is what you got right now. And that's a great thing to think about in life. You want to think about the future. You want to have plans, but you got to live right now. This is what you got. The other thing that I think I've tried to live by and express to people before is, measure what you do. Don't measure what you say. And I know I specifically said that to some units where I was a CO. I just said, I want to be a unit that's known for what it does, not for what it says. And that's when we had, you know, bumper sticker units out there, America's Battalion, and all kinds of crap like that. And I say, let's be known for what we do. And I think that's woven in that philosophy somewhere. And if you think of, you know, I think Stockdale, rightfully recognized Medal of Honor recipient, he saved a lot of people's lives in those POW camps, and he saved a lot of this country's honor in those camps, because the Korean POW experience was not good for this country, and it would have been exploited even worse in those Vietnam POW camps if it weren't for a guy like Stockdale.
You know, he not only did he save their lives, right, in those camps, he saved their lives when they came home too. I mean, with what those guys did. Let me just read one paragraph, and then we'll find out what everybody's reading. But Epictetus, I had to listen to the pronunciation of his, and it's almost two words, Epictetus, explained that his curriculum was not about revenues or income or peace or war, but about happiness and unhappiness, success and failure, slavery and freedom. His model graduate was not a person able to speak fluently about philosophic principles as an idle babbler, but about things that will do you good if your child dies, if your brother dies, or if you must die or be tortured. Let others practice lawsuits, others study problems, others syllogisms. Here you practice how to die, how to be enchained, how to be racked, how to be exiled. A man is responsible for his own judgments, even in dreams, in drunkenness, and in melancholy madness. Each individual brings about his own good or his own evil, his own good fortune, his ill fortune, his happiness, and his wretchedness. It is unthinkable that one man's error could cause another man's suffering. Suffering, like anything else in Stoicism, is all internal. Remorse at destroying yourself. So to me, I'm reading this and I'm like, I write literally in the margin, holy shit, exclamation mark, post-traumatic winning, right?
That's like Frankel, man.
Right. No, it is the same thing. And I read that and I had the same lament that you guys have expressed, was this, man, I wish somebody had made it interesting for me to study Stockdale and then to read about those things of value and what you can and cannot do. Because much of it, I mean, I kind of experienced in like, yeah, you know, it sucks. It sucks. Now what? Right? Let's fucking go. And so anyway. All right, let's any final thoughts about Stoicism or Epictetus?
Yes,
go ahead.
Tim said vicissitudes. That knocks apt off the fucking board. And in this place where there's a paucity of eloquence, Tim takes the prize.
Congratulations, Timothy. All right. What are you reading, Will?
I'm reading that Ian Toll series. So I finished the first one. I'm into the second one. We're in Guadalcanal. Something came to mind. In this book, he's writing the history, but he also does little biographical vignettes of some of the big players. And one of the things he talks about is all the admirals at the beginning of the war, all were Naval Academy graduates. In another part, he talks about the Naval Academy education that they went through. Rote knowledge, engineering, math, and trade school stuff. Think navigation, seamanship, etc. And so you think that's not a really good education. Interesting, though, that Naval Academy education of rote learning, engineering, math, and trade school stuff produced a generation of Navy officers that were willing to fight. Mm-hmm. And it also produced probably the greatest naval and military strategists that the country's ever had. King, Nimitz, etc. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of your, your Western liberal arts education, I don't know. The Naval Academy in the early, double O's and teens produced a lot of guys that were not afraid to get in and fight. So who knows?
You know what? To me, liberal arts education is bullshit education. And I know because I got one. It's great if you want to sit around a cappuccino place and discuss the great ideas of today, right? But I told my kids, look, if you're not going to go be an accountant, an engineer, or an architect, major in English. You'll be well spoken, well read, well written, and well thought. Okay, the rest of it is all bullshit. Right. And so I was surprised. I didn't think at the academies you could get anything other than a hard science degree. And I was a little bit surprised when I found out that, oh, no, you could major in political science. I said,
yeah,
I thought that was really against the rules.
It's a half-assed degree. You get a Bachelor of Science in political science. You get a Bachelor of Science and an undesignated degree.
Nice.
So
yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that.
Anyways, I would just say that that Ian Toll series on the Pacific is it's phenomenal, and I absolutely like, you know, Hornfisher and another guy, Frank, who I talked about probably 2 months ago, who just started. This is you can't separate them because they're all about the same topic, but they come at it slightly different way. And if you've read every book about the Pacific War there is, you're still going to learn something if you read this stuff by Ian Toll. Really good books.
Wow. Wow. Tim, what are you reading?
Hey, I'm in the middle of doing my thesis, so I'm still stuck on Education for Death, The Making of a Nazi. But I wanted to real quick give a shout-out to Tom Wade, who listens to the show regularly. He's up in Dallas, who I have incorrectly identified as a former Airedale Navy type. He actually enlisted in the Army, was a grunt in 65. He graduated high school, enlisted in the Army in 66. Off to Vietnam, he went. Now somebody just follows a lot of his story, very involved in naval history. And he's the guy that told me about Toll. And I just wanted to pass that on to him. And I also have to tell you, I just downloaded, in order to look for some stuff that I can put into my thesis, quotes, When the Tempest Gathers by Andy Milburn, as I'm trying to portray what he did as basically being a punitive raid style of a response as opposed to what we've done in the past. So I'll be reading Andy's book here soon in order to fish for quotes that validate my preconceived notions. Because that's what you do in academia, I think.
Of course.
To avoid the vicissitudes.
Exactly.
Jeffrey, what are you reading?
Well, you know, I've been watching these, the whole, you know, hurly burly over the Senate confirmation of the Supreme Court. So I'm thinking, I don't know shit about the Supreme Court. So I got the book by Cruz, about One Vote Away is the name of it. It's about these decisions that the Supreme Court justices have done. And so I started reading it today, actually, and I'll tell you, I burned through about 40 pages of it. And just one thing I'll say about it is he talks about in the foreword about the election, the run-up to the election, how his campaign had won like 8 primaries. And this is the irony of this whole thing, is the media decided that Trump was going to be the guy. And there's a huge everything Trump did, even when he didn't win primaries, it was just getting all the coverage. You got like millions of dollars worth of free coverage for everything. And the reason was, and they admit this, is that they figured of all the nominees who had a chance, Rubio and Cruz and, you know, and Trump and, you know, a couple others, that the one who would do the least, had the least amount of chance of beating Hillary was Trump, ironically. And but the whole book is like the way the guy talks.
Oh, really?
It's interesting. It's well done. You know, and it's funny. You know, so I'll let you know more about it as I go through it.
All right. No, it's interesting. Now that you mention it, I don't know that I've read very much about the Supreme Court either.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes up. I couldn't watch any of that. I mean, to me, it's just the nation at its worst, our political theater.
You're absolutely right.
Ugh, God. And so I've seen it passing by the monitor, but I don't have the moral courage to ingest that. Because to me, she is eminently qualified,
mm-hmm.
right? And to be on the Supreme Court, but we're going to do what we do in this country. The the last thing I should give you guys a chance to I don't know if you followed this, but no, maybe I won't. In the last couple of weeks, there's been two things, right? You have academics in the country standing up and saying, hey, look, to the Pulitzer Committee that awards those prizes, you need to look at rescinding the award you gave to the New York Times and the woman who wrote, the chief author, who's a reporter, by the way, at the Times, of the 1619 Project. You need to look at rescinding. So, like, of all the people to have the moral courage in the nation to stand up and stand up and look at the council culture and say, yeah, we're not having it, right? It's, you know, guys in tweed jackets with pipes. Those guys have the moral courage to stand up, which I find ironic, but it's nonetheless true, right? And so, and then counter, I guess just opposed to that would be this documentary that Amazon has said doesn't meet its publishing criteria. And it's a documentary done by Shelby Steele, right? I believe he's a PhD, works out of the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. Right. I mean, renowned guy, black American, conservative. He and his son do this documentary that talks about, Michael Brown, and they, they go interview people and they talk to organizers and they go through the evidence, but it's not the narrative. Amazon will not offer that in its streaming, that documentary in its streaming service. They made that decision yesterday, but the 1619 project is pushed all over the world by the New York Times. And I ask you guys, where does this all go? How does this all end? Where does it take the country when news outlets, now their task is to shape current events to fit the narrative that's being put out on Facebook and Twitter. I mean, that's bizarro world, but yet that's what we see more and more. And now we see really the suppression or the censoring of content done by intellectual academic type people with great credibility because of the fear of backlash. And it's just, to me, it's astounding to watch on a daily basis when you can have major platforms in the country rejecting academic work done by somebody because it simply doesn't, it will get them canceled. It will compromise their business or in some way, shape, or form that we're now going to be the thought police, the McCarthy, right? And any thoughts on that, Will?
Yeah, I mean, is the steam building, is the thing going to explode? At what point do people say they've had enough? And when they say they had enough, does it mean that they go out and engage in a debate with their 400 million firearms in private hands that come out? Victor Davis Hanson wrote a really good column, I think it was in Today, and it just talked about the politicization of institutions and how people have done things for a short-term political gain and it's destroyed their brand. And he talks about, Pulitzer Committee, the Nobel Committee, the NBA. I don't know if that's going to resonate with people or not. Show me a path that you continue to go down this road and it ends well. That's a fairy tale.
Got it. Tim, thoughts on how this ends or where the continuing down this road takes it?
Yeah, but I'm going to double down to what I said yesterday, because there's no question that observable reality and the narrative are so far apart that it's just difficult to believe that we're dealing with this kind of stuff. I say you and the thousands of people like you who have audiences that every day are talking about things in a long form podcast form, I think that is the only counter we have to this, because there's no such thing as a successful podcast that's parroting the narrative and reinforcing what you hear in the news. That does not exist. The closest to that are the late night comedians, and they're dying. They're not even funny or relevant anymore. They're pathetic. So the only vibrant force inside of the American population these days is coming through, I believe, the podcasting folks and folks like that. And that's why, not that you are responsible for the Trump train of McAllen, but, all across the country, there's these gigantic spontaneous Saturday Trump rallies and whatnot. You'll never see one for Biden, and you'll never hear about him on the news. And the fact that you don't hear about him on the news is why everybody likes to go to him. So I feel hope because of you, my friend, and those that are just like you, working hard to educate the population on a reasonable perspective. I honestly mean that.
Yeah, I just It's just, I'm astounded when a guy like Shelby Steele, right, when nobody at Amazon in their content police doesn't look around and say, hey, we can't do this. This is wrong. Yeah. But it's like, oh no, we've got to do this. I mean, we'll get canceled. We'll get this. We'll get that. You know, and I don't know. It's just I don't know. Will asked a good question. How does this not end in violence? And I believe it will.
But there is one way. The only way left is, like Timmy said, and you said, competition. Competition in regards to free speech.
Right.
You know, where people come out like you, like your podcast, like other podcasts that don't do that. I have to tell you, I got a little bit of hope because I'm like, we're watching TV and I'm getting sick of the hearings because we're fast forwarding after a while through the Democrat guys because it's just fucking infuriating, you know.
Right.
And but I'm reading my thing. Up pops this article about, of all people, Ice Cube, and Ice Cube had this like plan he wanted to do for South Central LA, and you know, to try and get him out of the financial doldrums they're in. He communicates it to the Democratic Party, and they're like, hey, look, we'll deal with this after the election. You know, we're not really interested in it now, but, you know, we'll get back to you. And so the Republican, Trump's guys reach out to him, and now this guy's making noises like he's a Trumper. I mean, this guy was like, you know, dyed in the wool against him. But the fact that someone's going to reach out and say, I want to hear what you have to say, and I'm not doing it for any other, and I realized that the true value in me listening to you is me doing something about it. In other words, like, it's not like what Will was saying about those bumper sticker units. We actually, at least they, you know, intimated, we'll do something about it, and this is what we'll do. So there's actually a back and forth now between those two. So that means Ice Cube, you know, is probably going to, if things work out well with this, he's probably going to come out a 180 from what he was before. And so if a lot of people who are just, you know, gullible and are believing the stuff that does come out of Amazon and ignoring the fact that this happened, maybe, you know, when enough of this comes out, they'll seek out those publications that want to compete with these guys and say, I want to find this thing and read it. And when they do, they change. And if enough people change, then we don't have to go to the guns. But I have to tell you, I mean, I just, in my neighborhood, 2 days ago, holy cow, we had two out in the street fist fights between people over Trump and Trumpers and stuff. I mean, I'm watching from the balcony. You've been to my house, Mac.
Right.
I'm watching
right.
from the balcony. I'm like, holy shit. And the cops pull up and they roll this dude up and they roll him up and they pull out, you know, he's got two knives in his backpack. I'm like, holy shit. And I'm walking my dog before that. And the, you know, another thing is screaming match that almost comes to blows, you know, and so it's like things are getting tense. And when Will says about the guns and everything, that's a possibility. You know, I mean, everybody's got guns now, both sides. You know,
I want to ask you guys one more question. To comment on one more question, a thought I had this morning about is, you know, we've all heard about this concept of this idea of white privilege. What about the concept of American privilege? If you took poor people from around the world and you brought them and said, okay, this is what it looks like to be poor in the United States. You live in a house. You got a cell phone. You got a car. You probably got cable TV.
You're overweight.
Your kids can go to school. There's a meal program. There's welfare for you. What do you think the poor people of the world would look and say to the poor people of the United States? Will?
Well, it's obvious. That's why everyone's trying to get here. Right? Who's trying to break into China?
Mm-hmm. Nobody. Maybe the North Koreans, but that would be about it.
Yuck.
Exactly. Tim, American privilege, you know, what would the rest of the poor people say if we got them in a set of bleachers and said, this is the deal about being poor in the United States? What would they say?
Well, I think you can actually see that in a number of people that I know of who have immigrated to the country, not understanding what we do for people and are flat out amazed. I would add that, and one of these things that is well known by us and people that travel and never is discussed. It is why I think Africans hold African Americans in such high contempt, because they come over here and succeed wildly, because we offer a hand up to everybody. There's no question. I don't believe that Americans have any idea of what it's like to live in a place where your security of person is not guaranteed. You know, where like I saw the other day, I saw the police roll up and they're arresting some young woman for whatever reason. Her friends were there. It was all going pretty calmly. They're stuffing her in the back of the car. But you know for a fact that that woman's not going to be molested or anything like that. She's going to be taken to the police station, treated respectfully. Whatever her issue is will be handled in a fair and equitable manner. In other countries I've lived in, you see them stuffing a girl in the back of the police car. She's in for a long night.
Right.
And that's something that people here don't even understand. So they don't understand the level of prosperity that we've generated that allows us to have the leisure to hold ourselves in contempt when we're the ones that built this goddamn bad boy and are not being jerks about sharing it with everybody. That's one of those ironies.
You know? No, I don't know why that popped into my head. Well, let me get Jeff, and I've kept you guys too long, but Jeff, if the world's poor sitting in the bleachers listening to American, what we would call poor, what would they say?
Well, I agree with exactly what Will and what Tim said. But there's if you're paying attention to this, there's been a disturbing phenomenon that's on the offing. Like, for instance, in Minnesota, where Ilhan Omar, her district,
right,
it has an overwhelming number of Somali immigrants. And their attitude is not the attitude of, oh, my God, this place is great, I'm going to make my way. Their attitude is one of contempt, not only for the people, but for the form of government. And they're the only ones, you know, who are really still pushing for, we want to have Sharia law, we want to have this and that. And we don't, you know, and they're actually, they don't see any point in representing a form of government. And so the more of these little enclaves we got like that, and I don't know why we're doing it, but, you know, that's a burgeoning, you know, phenomenon that's going on right now. You got insular groups of immigrants who are, you know, developing anti-American. It's never happened like that before. Everybody from the Jews, the Italians, the Irish, everybody's like, oh my God, you know, I got a shot at success here. And you know, God bless America and all this stuff. There's something new in the air.
Yeah, you know, but I would attribute that to almost the march of most immigrants. You know, most immigrants, first generation, come here, right? They stay in the enclave. They keep their culture. Their kids then learn English. They want a skateboard. You know, the girls want to wear yoga pants, right? And then, you know, by the second and a half generation, that shit is done, right?
Yeah, I hope you're right. I mean, yeah, that's a valid point, and I hope you're right.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that if you assembled poor people, I mean, I didn't know what – I thought poor was something I saw around my high school in Sacramento, California. And then I went to the Philippines. And, I mean, I remember being stunned, right? Houses made of cereal boxes. You know, the rains, heavy rains come. They get washed away. Kids running around naked. You know, and I just thought, we don't have too many really poor people in the United States. I mean, so I think if you assembled, so this idea of American privilege, right? So you think you're disadvantaged and you can go to school, even to college for free, that you can get fed on a daily basis, that you could get this and this and this in this in your country? They would belly laugh. They would belly laugh and say, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Do you not know how the rest of us live? We should beat your asses so we could take your spot. No, I just thought this whole idea of white privilege, I mean, shit, the whole country is privileged. Yet there's some that, in my opinion, that won't take advantage and embrace, you know, what it is to be a victim. And to me, the ideas of stoicism push against that. You know, regardless of any kind of American concept, that you are responsible for you and you have to get your ass out of that situation. And you tend to do that by working your ass off, going to school, right? And live in the straight and narrow. And if you don't want to do that, then there's nothing anybody can do for you to make you well. Anyway, all right, boys. Thank you very much for your input, William, Timothy, Jeffrey. Well done.
Hoorah. Bye. Thank you, sir.
Hoorah.
All
right. There you have it. The Mensa brothers. That'll do it on a Friday. Origin email just popped in. Wow. Talk about a little bit of ground. China, Taiwan, race, stoicism, and then American privilege. That's a relatively flexible program, Mac. Honestly, it's the thing that I enjoy most about my friends, is their intellectual dexterity. It is. As much as I shit on a liberal arts education, I enjoy liberal arts discussions like the one you just heard immensely. And because none of them will give you what you want. They're all very independent thinkers. But again, as I've said before, it's what I enjoy most about my friend. They are not afraid to get it on intellectually, and they're all smart, and they all have a ton of worldly experiences, which I think you hear on this program every Thursday. So my thanks to them, to Will and Tim and Jeff for coming on today. If you missed hour one, I talk about a couple things. I talk about Shelby Steele's rejection by Amazon. And that this Orwellian thing that we have going on in the United States, where it is now the responsibility of companies like Amazon, companies like the New York Times, to shape what you see, what you read, to fit the narrative that's on social media. And the narrative on social media is a lie. And it's really, in my opinion, astounding. And then I talk about this idea of American privilege. You know? So remember that when somebody points a finger at somebody else, three fingers point back at them, and you start scrutinizing the argument. Okay, well, maybe some people are more privileged. The privilege to be born middle class in the United States is to go to school, to get a job, to work hard, to make something of yourself, and work your life. Right? That's the privilege. If you're a minority, there's other hurdles in your way. If you're a minority and poor, or even if you're white and poor, there are other hurdles in your way. But I would say know this. Look around the world, man. Let me tell you, when I went to the Philippines the first time, I was stunned. And then this shit I saw in Hong Kong, I think it's what, over in Kowloon? Whoa. Then in Thailand? I'd never seen poor people like that in my life. So you'll hear that in hour one. And then you'll also hear Professor Alan Lichtman, who successfully predicted the outcome of every election. He says that Joe Biden will win. And so he got on my radar after the election in 2016 because he had predicted that Donald Trump would beat Hillary Clinton. So you'll hear him again. He appeared on a broadcast done by Michael Schmierkanish, who's about the only thing that I think is halfway decent on CNN. And I think Schmierkanish is very good. So, with all that said, have a great Thursday. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. It's a good thing to do. And I'll tell you what, you can find, if you go to the All Marine Radio website, if you go to the post-traumatic winning tab and you just hover on that tab, you'll see it unfold. And then once it unfolds, At the bottom, you'll see PTW resources. And those are things that I use in the class. At the bottom of the page, you'll see a thing that says other links. And then you'll see two papers, Stockdale on Stoicism 1, The Stoic Warrior's Triad, and a second one, Stockdale on Stoicism 2, Master My Fate. Read those for a good introduction to what we were talking about today. The Stoics. I misunderstood the Stoics because Stoic to me meant, you know, you, I think the literal definition of the word Stoic is that you're outwardly definition, a person who can endure pain or hardship without showing their feelings or complaining. That's not what a Stoic is, right? Although that's the definition of the word. The second part of the definition is to a member of the ancient philosophical school of Stoicism. So, and I would recommend it to you. And like I said, when I was reading through that stuff, and I read the section that said this, his model graduate was not a person able to speak fluently about philosophic principles as an idle babbler, but about things that will do you good if your child dies, if your brother dies, or if you must die or be tortured. And I thought, that's when I wrote, holy shit, post-traumatic winning. So certainly a wide strain of Stoicism in post-traumatic winning that you do choose. You decide how you respond to the events that fate puts in front of you, that life puts in front of you, or how God puts in front of you, however you would characterize that. And so I would certainly recommend that. So on that note, have a great Thursday. All Marine Radio is out.